From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Recently, the economist and scholar Russell Roberts was asked to describe the global financial crisis. Shakespearean was his answer. It's a play, he said, a tragedy with a huge cast of players and an incredibly complex plot. Roberts uses his own plots to explain the Byzantine dynamics of economies. He writes what are called economic novels. He gives theories and systems a narrative framework to help people understand how all of this works. His latest novel explores what Roberts describes as the hidden order of the economic system, the idea that there are forces that create order even though there's no deliberate design, the virtues, he says, of leaving things alone. As you may have guessed, Roberts is an advocate of a free market, and he's the latest voice in our series exploring the country's broken economy. Roberts will join us today. We hope you will too, after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. A conventional wisdom has emerged about the country's economic crisis, at least among some. It goes something like this: that the meltdown was the cause of rampant greed and deregulation. The conclusion some have come to is that the free market doesn't work, not completely, and that government is going to have to step in to restore order. Our guest today doesn't buy it. Russell Roberts is an economist and a novelist. He writes what are called economic novels, books that take complex theories and systems and give them a narrative framework to help people understand how all of this works. His latest novel involves a tennis star and a Stanford professor who teaches the hidden order of the economic system, this idea that there are forces that create order even though there's no deliberate design. Roberts is the latest voice in our series exploring the country's broken economy, and we invite you to join the conversation today. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Russell Roberts is a professor of economics at George Mason University and a research fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. He's written three books in the genre, economic novels. He's also the host of a weekly podcast, Econ Talk, which is a finalist, we should say, for Best Podcast in the 2008 Weblog Awards. His latest book that we mentioned is called The Price of Everything, A Parable of Possibility and Prosperity. And Russell Roberts is joining us today from his office in Arlington, Virginia. And Russell Roberts, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
I wanted to begin by asking about these economic novels. When did this idea occur to you to write these, and what were you trying to do? Because it seems it's more than just making a complex idea palatable. There's something more in there for you, it seems.
Yeah, I'm trying to give people a flavor of the poetry of economics, which sounds like the ultimate oxymoron. But my claim is that economics is about everyday life, and it's about the beauty and marvel that our economic system creates and that we're all a part of without usually knowing that. And so I found that by telling the economic principles in the form of a story, the vividness and emotional impact of these economic principles comes to the fore the way they can't in a graph or a chart or a bunch of equations. The way economics is usually taught in college, for those of you out there who have taken it, will remember it's usually taught, unfortunately, as a very dry, theoretical subject, when in fact it's a framework for looking at the world in a whole new way for most people who are not familiar with it. And I found that by telling stories, I can make that those effects more vivid.
It made me wonder if you were then a class of yours is somewhat like Ruth Lieber. She's the professor in your novel.
Well, yeah, there's a little of me in all of my books. In all my books, there's someone who knows something, usually economics, we hope, and a character who is either curious or hostile to the economic way of thinking. And so I find my voice occasionally getting into those conversations, at least I try to. In Ruth Lieber's case, she's about to retire administrator at Stanford who was once and still teaches a little bit in the classroom. And so it's natural for me to find my voice in hers.
Well, let's explore the plot a little bit more. The curious character, the hostile character, I guess, in your book is
a little of both
is Ramon Fernandez. He is a very successful tennis player, Cuban American, And I want to have you set this up for us and read a section. This is on page 6, because this moment is sort of the clincher for him, and this is what begins this dialogue between Ramon Fernandez and Ruth Lieber. Set this up for us first, and then read this section, if you would.
Okay, so Ramon comes to the United States as a little boy in a somewhat similar way that Elian Gonzalez came. Mm. His mother risks her life and gets on a boat with him, and they come to Miami. And his father had been a legendary Cuban baseball player, and she knows he's a talented kid, but she doesn't want him to grow up in Cuba. So they end up in the United States. She cleans houses in Miami, and he becomes this young tennis star that earns him a scholarship at Stanford, where he's eating dinner one night in his girlfriend's apartment when an earthquake comes, as they often do in the Bay Area, and this is a big one. The lights go out, the power goes out, and they finish their dinner by candlelight, but she realizes, his girlfriend Amy realizes, that they don't have any supplies, milk and basics and flashlight batteries, etc. So they have to go out into the world to find some so-called necessities.
Right.
That's on the first page or two. It sounds like a long, complicated plot, but that's all gets set up. So they go out and they head out to Home Depot to buy some basic stuff like flashlights, etc. But Home Depot is sold out of just about everything they need, and they go to this other store, which is a mythical, fictional store called Big Box.
Right.
And Big Box has everything that you'd want. They got plenty in stock the night of the earthquake, even hours after it's started and finished, and the power's been out for a while. But Big Box has decided to double its prices that night. So this is I use this as an example of what people call price gouging. Yeah. In the aftermath of an earthquake or a hurricane, sometimes prices will spike upward. And the book opens with this scene of Ramon being very upset because a person in line in front of him can't afford her formula for her baby, and people are outraged that they're being gouged. There's an angry crowd that's forming, even though some people are shopping happily inside because right. there's lots of stuff available.
Right.
So one of the sub-themes of the book is the tension between the role of prices in allocating goods and getting stuff to us and making sure that Big Box and other stores have the incentive to stock up, even though sometimes there won't be an earthquake, versus the fact that when prices are high, people sometimes can't afford the things that they really want and desperately need. So this creates a tension between Ramon and Ruth, who is the economist in the story, the soon-to-retire teacher. And the scene that you're talking about is right after Ramon has seen this woman crying because she can't afford formula for her baby, and Amy, his girlfriend, has been in line with him, and she goes out to the store to find Ramon, outside the store to find Ramon.
Right.
And it goes like this. When Amy got outside, she found Ramon up on the stacked bags of mulch in front of the store. Next to him was the Mexican woman with her baby. Next to her was the same Big Box employee they'd seen before at the front of the store. He looked as if he wanted to run away, but Ramon was using the megaphone that belonged to Big Box. The employee felt he ought to stay close to company property. The crowd had grown a lot larger and a lot quieter. Seeing Ramon Fernandez up on a mulch mountain with a megaphone at 1 a.m. made people stop to see what was going on. What kind of store decides to profit off of hungry children and a caring mother? We need to send a message to Omaha. The crowd roared back its approval. Amy marveled at Ramon's initiative and style. He looked as relaxed and natural as he did on a tennis court. Ramon went on for a while and got the crowd good and angry. If he'd given the word, they'd have smashed every window at the front of the store. But he had a different plan. Instead, he lowered his voice and slowed his cadence. He spoke about the desperation of poverty and the need to restrain corporate power. The people in the crowd looked up at him transfixed, and when he was done, they applauded and started filling out the complaint cards. And in the aftermath of this episode, Ramon's going to get tangled up in a campus protest at Stanford, because it turns out that Big Box is a large contributor to Stanford University in the story. And Ramon's also the graduation speaker, being a competitor at Wimbledon and quite a well-known figure around the country. Ruth, the provost, is a little bit worried about what he might say at that graduation speech, so their conversations start to begin, and they start talking about a whole bunch of economic phenomena.
What's great about it, what's really intriguing, is that you give it now a human dimension. I mean, you draw us in because there's a real story for us to connect to, and I guess that's the power of this of the narrative. The way you're doing this is you draw us in, and this gives it a sense of a kind of a clarity. That's what you're going for.
Yeah, and I want the reader to care. Yeah. I want the reader to care about what happens to that mother who can't afford the formula, and to start thinking about what are the different ways we might prevent that from happening. What are the costs and benefits, the pluses and minuses, and what kind of world do we want to live in? And to answer that question, you have to understand how the world works a little bit. And for me, what economics gives us is a framework for thinking and organizing our thinking about the complexity of the world. The world's a very complicated place. It's pretty obvious that's the case right now with what's going on in the United States and elsewhere. And economics doesn't have all the answers. What it's useful for is more to think about what the right questions are to keep us from making disastrous mistakes. It sometimes points us to solutions. But as I think Thomas Sowell once said, the lesson of economics is that there are no solutions, only trade-offs. There are things that are better for some people and worse for others. And often that's the choice we have to end up making.
You've said, Russell Roberts, that we as a people lack a kind of a reverence, I think awe was the word you used, for the hidden order of markets, the fact that these systems work without any real deliberate design. Explain that.
Well, there are a lot of things in the world around us that are orderly and appear to be designed by someone when, in fact, they're not. Some of the examples I use in my writing, some of these are in the book, would be the availability of, say, a bagel on Super Bowl Sunday. Right. There should not be a bagel available on Super Bowl Sunday. Super Bowl Sunday is the largest pizza day of the year. When you walk into a bakery or a grocery store or a coffee shop on the Sunday morning of Super Bowl Sunday, and you ask if they have any bagels, it should be perfectly natural that the response should be, are you kidding? All the dough, all the wheat, all the flour, that went to pizzas. It's Super Bowl Sunday. But, of course, that's not the case. There are plenty of bagels. There's plenty of other things available for us, even though there's no czar who's worried about the bagel supply. The other example I use in the book is pencils, because it's a very simple product. And even though it's simple, it's quite complicated. When you think about the people who contribute to the construction of a pencil, they're all over the world. There are graphite miners in Sri Lanka, and there's aluminum smelters in Korea, and there's people who make the lacquer in Tennessee, and there's the cedar tree that was grown in California. All these people around the world are working on this. And when China sends a few hundred million more children into schools because their parents have migrated from the countryside into the city, well, the effect on that in the United States should be you can't get a pencil. I mean, you should show up at a pencil store, at a office supply store, or the campus bookstore, and try to get a pencil. The response should be, well, don't you know about what's going on in China? Hundreds of millions of kids are using pencils. They're going to school now for the first time. Come back in 6 months. But, of course, that doesn't happen. There's this harmony in the world of availability of supply where there should be all this tension between the different suppliers who want the different materials that go into these products, and yet we never see that tension. The harmony is what we see, and we don't notice the harmony because we're so spoiled by the fact that there's always stuff on the shelves waiting for us. You know, there's an amazing, I use this in the book also, an amazing scene in the movie The Truman Show, where Truman, this character, is living in a fake world. He doesn't realize that he's the only person in his world who is real. Everyone else is an actor. He doesn't realize he's being filmed. He's a person of great routine. He goes every day to the same newsstand, buys the same magazines, the same newspapers. And then one day in the opening of the film, it's a great film, I recommend it, the opening of the film, he goes off the path. He tries something new. He's spontaneous. And he wanders off, and the person, the director of the show, who's named Christoph, is on the radio on his little headset, desperately telling the other character to move stuff around so that Truman will not notice that the whole thing is fake. And think about our own lives. In our own lives, we wake up every morning, and we can do whatever we want. We can decide to get the bagel on Super Bowl Sunday instead of the pizza. We can decide to take up exercise instead of being a couch potato. We can decide to learn a language or play the guitar or change our careers, and all the stuff we need is just right there. We don't call anybody in advance. We don't send a memo. We just expect it to be there, and it is. And that harmony, I use the image of the weaver of dreams. There's nobody weaving our dreams, and yet they don't conflict. I can have my exercise equipment and all the stuff I need to get more fit, and if you want to be a couch potato, you can have 20 different flavors of potato chips to choose from. So somehow, all of our dreams are interacting, using all kinds of different stuff, without the tension and conflict which you'd think would be inevitable. So my awe and marveling at this is the fact that without a coordinator, without anyone running the economy, without a czar, that stuff just sitting there, it gets produced. You decide to be a vegetarian. People decide to go off carbohydrates. All these new products get developed, and everybody else gets what they want too. Sometimes it might get more expensive. It's not a perfect fantasy world. But the fact that it works as smoothly as it does and how that works is something I think every thinking human being should be interested in.
You know, the critical dilemma that I think people have with the idea is that you have to impose some kind of moral order on a system that is just because it will drag the weak under. There's something wrong with that, that humans have to impose some kind of check on all of this in order to make it work humanely. How do you respond to that? Because you talk about that also in the book.
Sure, because what's driving that harmony that I've alluded to is self-interest, yeah. Ironically. What drives the fact that the fresh bagel is waiting for me at the coffee shop on Sunday morning, on every Sunday morning, not just Super Bowl Sunday, but every Sunday morning, and it's hot, and it's fresh, and I've got 8 flavors to choose from, and it's relatively inexpensive. That's driven not by the baker's love for me, as Adam Smith was one of the first to observe, but by the baker's self-interest that if the baker does a good job, the customers will keep coming. If the baker does a bad job, I'll search out alternatives. So what restrains the baker's self-interest of putting up a lousy product of stale bagels at high prices is the fact that I have choices. And the question always is, the relevant question is, are those choices sufficient to protect me from the natural self-interest that all human beings have? And in our system, I would argue that is often the case. That protection is there, and it emerges naturally. It's not imposed from above. There's no agency, governmental, state or federal or city, that makes sure that the bagel maker charges a fair price. Now, there sometimes is. There can be these anti-gouging laws, which I discuss in the book also. Yeah. But in general, in our common daily experience, the marketplace through competition is what protects me from the self-interest of the baker or others getting out of hand. What's remarkable, and I try to capture this in the book as well, is that the little person, the unskilled person, the underprivileged person in a market system often thrives over time. At a point in time, you take a snapshot of a capitalist economy, it's people doing great, people not doing so great. Over time, what happens is that our children and children's children lead better and better lives than we do, or than their grandparents or great-grandparents did. Now, there's some debate as to whether that's going to continue in the current world. I'm an optimist on that, but over American history, over the last couple hundred years, there is no doubt that market creativity, entrepreneurship, innovation, technology has lifted people out of thousands, millions of people out of poverty, and has forced the entrepreneur and the innovator to share the profits of those gains with the everyday person. We see that in our lives all the time. We see that in the form of inexpensive cell phones and washing machines and televisions, computers, cars, things that were everything in our life that was a luxury for only the rich when they first come out, eventually become standard fare for the masses. That's a unique phenomenon in human history. That is not the most of human history. It's only the last couple hundred years in the capitalist developed economies. We see it happening in the less developed economies in places like India and China that have unleashed some of their creativity, still have a long way to go, that have brought millions, tens of millions of people out of poverty, and they still, of course, have a long way to go. But I think it's very important that you can't look just at a snapshot. You want to look at the movie. You want to see how it plays out over time.
801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Before we go to break, let's take a call. Craig is with us, calling from Salt Lake City. Craig, welcome to the program.
Thank you. My comment is that I think the Founding Fathers would say to Adam Smith that if you're talking about an economy that is populated by small merchants and little farmers, that people acting in their own self-interest does create ideal economic conditions. But we have a vastly aggregated economy now where corporate executives assume a fiduciary. And when they act in their own self-interest, then what we've seen lately is that greed overwhelms that fiduciary. And that is what the Founding Fathers understood about government, and that is why we have three branches of government that oversee each other and try to provide a responsible fiduciary.
Russell Roberts, you've heard that argument before. How do you respond?
Well, it's an interesting point. I think there is always an issue of responsibility in any setting, whether it's a corporate setting, a family setting, or a government setting. When our system works right, prudence is rewarded and recklessness is punished. It's a profit and loss system. So the profits are what encourage people to take risks and to innovate, and the losses are what punish people who make bad decisions or are unlucky or do poorly. And you got to have both. Sometimes, of course, what happens is that we insulate people from the losses, and that encourages recklessness, or there are parts of the system where people get taken advantage of. That's certainly a reality. But I think when you look at the Founding Fathers, they were remarkably tolerant of economic freedom. We, in the last, I'd say, 120 years, have systematically reduced economic freedom. And the caller's concern is a real one. Unfortunately, when government has acted to reduce economic freedom, I don't think it's done it mostly in the name of what the caller wants to see, which is protecting people from corporate malfeasance or greed or whatever you want to call it. It's often used, tragically, to enhance the wealth of one corporation at the expense of the rest of us, or one corporation at the expense of another. So a lot of government regulation, which is in name designed to protect the consumer, often only protects certain corporations who are politically powerful. So I think we need to be extremely careful, especially in these times, in using government power, which is by definition concentrated and is run by human beings, not angels, just like everything else in the world. And we need to be aware of the fact that it doesn't always run the way it's described.
Craig, glad you called. Thanks very much. 801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Russell Roberts is with us today. He's the host of the weekly podcast Econ Talk. There's a link to it, by the way, on our website at kuer.org. He's also a novelist, and his latest book is called The Price of Everything, A Parable of Possibility and Prosperity. We're going to take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we continue our series talking about the country's broken economy and what the incoming president should do to fix it. The economist and novelist Russell Roberts is with us today. He's the author of the book The Price of Everything, A Parable of Possibility and Prosperity. You can join us at 801-585-WEST, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. So, Russell Roberts, let's get to this—the question of what then should be done. This, you know, as you, this conventional wisdom again that the market, free market, doesn't really work like we thought it did. That the government then is going to have to step in and spend all of this, spend to, you know, get things going again. How are you reacting to that idea? And what do you think needs to be done? Are you saying there needs to be, it needs, the system needs to be deregulated even more?
Well, I think there are two issues here. One is the financial side and one is the Main Street side. So the Wall Street and Main Street distinction, I think, is important. Wall Street has turned out rather badly in the last 10 months or so, and that is now spilling over into Main Street. But I think there's a distinction between what's happening in one and what's happening in the other and what the solutions are. For example, the automakers don't make good cars. It's true Wall Street has made their – America automakers don't make very good cars or very popular cars. The fact that Wall Street has caused that problem to get worse should not change our understanding that the fundamental problem of Detroit is Detroit. It's not due to some inherent problem in the system. Yes, it's been worsened by the current financial challenges, but the fundamental problem there is a Detroit problem, and our moves to bail them out is throwing good money after bad, and I think it's a major mistake. I think my viewpoint, though, is challenged greatly by what's happened on Wall Street lately, the last 10 months, and I think that's where it's a legitimate worry about whether we need more regulation or less regulation. The hard part for thinking about this cleanly and carefully is that Wall Street and the housing market, which are the tangled up things that got us into this mess, are, of course, heavily regulated. So the question is our current problem the result of too much regulation or too little?
Right.
And I think, you know, people, thoughtful people are going to disagree on that, but I think it's important for people to understand the role that regulation played in creating the current mess. We've had a whole bunch of government policies that inflated the housing market out of control. True, Wall Street then stepped in and found ways to make money off of that that turned out to be extremely unhealthy. The so-called collateralized debt obligations, the mortgage-backed securities, they are at the heart of this problem. But those securities and assets were only profitable because the government did a bunch of stuff to inflate housing way beyond what it would have been in a more market-oriented system. Those include things like government monetary policy. Alan Greenspan pushed interest rates too low for too long. The tax exemption of capital gains from housing that made housing a very attractive, artificially attractive investment relative to real investments of other kinds. Fannie and Freddie guaranteeing loans that were started off being reasonable but then turned out to be irresponsible. So there's all it's obviously a very complicated picture. Having said that, I want to make it clear that I'm not an anarchist.
Right.
Those of us who are fans of free markets, most of us feel the government does have a role to play, has a role to play in enforcing contracts, a role to play in the court system, a role to play in property rights. Those are all crucial parts of the free market system that government plays an important role. And the question is, should government go farther than that? And in general, I argue that often when government tries to make things better, it ends up making them worse.
801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Let's go back to the phones. Alan is with us, calling from Savannah, Georgia. Alan, welcome.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
As a committed free market person, how should I feel about bailing out an economy that I know will crash if we don't bail it out, but knowing long term that it's only going to raise the price of the most important asset in our economy, the cost of money through interest rates? How do I get around that paradox within my own mind as a free market? Thank you.
It's a good question, Alan. Thanks.
Well, you know, back in March, this thing started. The first domino in this whole mess we're in was there was a weekend back in March when Bear Stearns realized they weren't going to be able to meet their obligations the next morning or the next Monday. This was, I think, on a Thursday night or Friday, and they realized they were in big trouble. They got in touch with the with Ben Bernanke, the chair of the Fed. They got in touch with Hank Paulson, the Secretary of Treasury, and those two created a marriage of Bear Stearns with J.P. Morgan only by guaranteeing the bad investments, the subprime mortgages that Bear Stearns was holding. They put about a $29 or $32 billion guarantee to make the sale of Bear Stearns feasible. At the time, many of us were outraged and said this is a violation of free market principles. It's not a great thing for a democracy that this takes place in the middle of the night without any accountability, without any transparency, no justification. At the time, we were told it was crucial. It had to be done. We didn't have a choice. Why? Because if we didn't bail out Bear Stearns effectively, which is what they did, if we didn't guarantee those bad loans, the whole financial system would freeze up. Of course, it froze up anyway. Now, you could argue it would have froze up worse. You could argue it would take longer to unfreeze, and it's very possible. I don't know. Again, there's no inherent truth in either of those statements that we can really be sure about. But what's clear is that what was called a desperately needed measure turned out not to be much better than what we got after we did it anyway. Similarly, we were told we have to have this $700 billion bailout, the TARP program, the Toxic Asset Relief Program. We have to have it because if we don't have it, the economy's going to go off a cliff. Well, that program's been a disaster. We've spent about $350 billion. We gave most of the money to banks. Again, no accountability, no transparency. Again, not a democratic procedure. Not the body politic doesn't really know what's going on. And none of it really worked. They've changed focus two or three times. They started to use some of the money to bail out the auto companies, which to me is unconstitutional, totally unacceptable given how that money was allocated by Congress. And to what effect? The banks don't want to lend out the money. They got yelled at by Hank Paulson. It's an embarrassing moment in economic history. Secretary of the Treasury berating banks for failing to lend. Well, the reason they're not lending is because they're not comfortable about the future. They're anxious, as everyone is. And part of that anxiety is being created by the constant moving around of policy in Washington. So right now we're being told if we don't spend $1 trillion, because that's what it's going to end up being, if we don't spend $1 trillion in infrastructure spending and tax cuts, the economy is going to go off a cliff. number one, I think it may go off a cliff anyway. Number two, it may go off a cliff partly because that money is badly spent, or we're going to run a $1.2 trillion deficit, which is starting to get to be real money, folks.
Yeah.
And so my answer to those of you out there who are worried about market principles and the concentration of power in Washington, I'm not convinced that this plan is desperately needed. I'm convinced we're in trouble. What we need to do is get confidence back in the future, and to me, running a $1.2 trillion deficit is not the way to get people confident the future is going to be okay.
Well, that's your crucial point, is that this is really it's about incentives. That's the critical point, it seems.
That's correct. And we're not very good as economists or as policymakers in creating people's confidence in the future to give them the incentive they need to start investing, start creating new businesses again, start expanding, start lending and borrowing the way every healthy economy works. We don't have a roadmap for that. We don't have a recipe or a manual. We're going to be told we know how to do it by Washington and by Obama and by his advisors, who are very smart people, by the way. I have a lot of respect for them. They're phenomenal. But unfortunately, being really smart is not enough right now.
How do you I've heard recently this Keynesian argument that the government is the spender of last resort, and this idea of how you build up demand in the system if people aren't spending. How do you respond to that?
Well, that's an argument, and it's been tried many, many times without much success, although, again, people would debate and do debate how successful it's been. The New Deal is the one example people point to. For decades, people said the New Deal ended the Depression. Most economists now agree that it didn't. About half of economic historians in a survey in the 1990s said it may have prolonged the Depression. Then people say, well, it wasn't the New Deal. It was the war. The war is what got us out of the Depression. But actually, there's a lot of interesting evidence that suggests that although the war was good for the military side of the economy, not surprisingly, and it did reduce unemployment because a lot of people were soldiers. Yes, that's what happens when you coerce people through the draft. The rest of the economy didn't do so well. Consumption, it wasn't a prosperous economy. That's the work of Robert Higgs, who's done some very thoughtful work on what the true standard of living was in World War II. So historically, we have that one episode that Keynesians like to point to. When people try to use sophisticated statistical techniques, they get all kinds of different measures of how successful this kind of government spending is. We tried an episode last spring. President Bush and Congress gave people $160 billion. They appeared to have mostly saved it. It didn't really have a big impact on consumption. Whether the government spends stuff, it will increase consumption of the things the government spends the money on, but I want them to spend it wisely, doing it quickly as they're going to do. And with the normal political incentives, which are inevitable, I don't think they're going to spend it wisely. A lot of people say, we've got to have this stimulus package, but it can't have any pork in it. And I say, hoping or expecting that a stimulus package won't have any pork in it is like hoping and expecting a ham sandwich won't have any pork in it. I mean, that's the essence of what government does. They do projects in particular places that benefit the people who get the money. So I would expect them to respond to the political incentives that are inevitable in that kind of situation.
801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Let's go back to the phones. Andy is with us, calling from Moab. Andy, welcome.
Yeah, hey, Doug. You know, I agree with most of what's being said here, being sort of a liberal libertarian type, but the thing that concerns me is that we recognize alcohol addiction, we recognize heroin addiction, but there's an addiction to money, and what I'm saying there is that, you know, after your first billion, how much more do you need? And yet people can do great damage, and yet we consider it socially acceptable, and at some point their self-interest becomes absolutely destructive to the rest of us. Is it worth addressing the fact that we have this insane addiction and in a perverse admiration for people that just gather, you know, like the dog of the manger, gathers so much more than it can possibly use? Because I think at the heart of it, that's the biggest problem with the American system, is the addiction to money and the fact that we don't recognize that as a problem.
Well, Russell Roberts, you say there's a natural feedback loop in the system that puts a check on human nature going too far, it seems.
Yeah, although, you know, recent events suggest that feedback loop works a little slower than we sometimes might hope it would. The Madoff scandal being a great example of that.
Right.
Eventually, it falls apart. It took a long time, and it ruined a lot of people's lives. And if it turns out he's guilty as he's confessed to his children, he should be punished. And of course, a lot of people who took too much risk are being punished, but they had a good life for a long time along the way, and that is that's an injustice that is not easily fixed. I do want to sympathize with one thing important that the caller talks about, though. I don't think it's so much an addiction to money as I think it's very hard for human beings to say no to temptation. We all know that as individuals. But I think part of what's at the root of our current problem, both private and public, in terms of decisions that we've made, is the difficulty of saying no. Our deficit spending at the public level, our borrowing at the private level, our desire to see everyone own their own house, which is a lovely idea but is not realistic. It comes at a frightful cost, as we've seen. We just can't say no. We have the war in Iraq. It's expensive. Maybe it's important. Okay, if it is, what are we going to say no to? What are we going to do less of? Never, never is there anything we say less that we're going to sacrifice. We have trouble with that in our own lives. We want the big screen TV. We want the fancy house. We want the nice car. Normally, there are checks that keep you from having more of everything, that check that recklessness, that check that temptation. But we put in place public policies that unfortunately encourage it. And here we are in the aftermath of this, and we continue to have trouble saying no. Just a month ago, Hank Paulson injected money into capital markets because he was worried that consumers weren't borrowing enough. What world is this man living in? We're in the problem we're at because consumers borrowed too much, but he's so worried that it might start to fall apart or get frozen up that he's going to encourage consumers to lend. Similarly, we're running enormous government deficits now, although they're relatively small compared to the overall size of the economy, but we're going to make them even bigger. Wouldn't you think there might be some advantage to saying, let's spend less, let's live within our means? And just we're all like drunken teenagers, you know? Just trouble with restraint. It's not our best thing. And a good system builds in those restraints, and a bad system breaks them. And right now, for the last 10 months, we've been breaking those feedback loops that normally restrain people, and we will pay a price for it.
Russell Roberts is with us. He is the host of the weekly podcast Econ Talk, also the author of a number of books, among them The Price of Everything, A Parable of Possibility and Prosperity. You can join us at 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We need to take another brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are continuing our series of conversations about the nation's economy. We invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Economist and novelist Russell Roberts is our guest today. Let's go back to the phones. Keenan is with us. He's in Provo. Keenan, welcome.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Fine.
One thing that kind of has frustrated me has been that people don't realize that the economy and the free market economy is kind of a system of natural selection. And so my question is, what in the long run, what do we really have to gain if the government withholds such exorbitant spending? And if we, you know, if these companies that have gotten themselves in these tight situations, it is a loss of jobs and it will be painful for a while. But it seems to me that we only have to gain as companies that have done well are rewarded for the good practices.
Well, that's a good question. Should these bad companies die, Russell Roberts?
Yeah, well, you're really talking about a concept that Joseph Schumpeter put forward about 60 years ago called creative destruction. And it is the essence of what our system's about. Destruction is a very harsh word. Companies get destroyed. People don't get destroyed. It's important to remember that when a company goes out of business, the resources that the company's been using are freed up for more successful entrepreneurs and innovators to have access to. There is a personal cost, though, of course, because people are out of work for a while, and that is a part of our economic system that I think has been a very important part of our success. It's hard for us to stomach it. It's like we were speaking about earlier. It's hard for people to say no and deal with any kind of pain. I think part of the political pressure on the Obama presidency will be accepting some sacrificing and pain, which is not our political system's strong suit. But if you compare our situation to Europe, Europe has been much careful, or much more careful, about making sure that there's no pain. They have a much bigger safety net. They make it much harder for companies to fire people. As a result, they have a much less dynamic labor market, and they have a lot of trouble integrating young people and people with low skills, especially into that system. We've been much more successful at job creation and opportunities for newcomers. So it'd be very interesting to see how we deal with that pressure, but I think it's an excellent point.
Keenan, glad you called. Thanks very much. 801-585-WEST is that number. Max is with us, calling from Roy. Max, hi.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I just got a question for your guest as far as I did some research a while back, and I was just kind of looking at things, and I noticed that the CEO pay seemed to go up about the same time that in the Reagan when 401ks came about. And I was kind of wondering if that's about when we lost control of the CEO pay. Here we are, the individual investors who are owning this, and the CEOs are getting paid these multi-million dollars. And the question, I guess, one of my main question is how do we get control of it? A quick comment to go with it is I know, like with GM, you know, GM guy takes, says I'll make a dollar a year. Well, it's easy to make a dollar a year when you've been making $10 million a year. And then they want the unions are there to, you know, if a CEO can make all that money, why can't an individual person make $15 or, you know, $17 an hour?
It's a good question. Russell Roberts, what do you think?
It is a good question, and I particularly like the point about making a dollar a year after you've been handsomely paid for a few decades. It's a lot easier to make what appears to be a grand gesture. CEO pay is an interesting issue. It's a small part of, I think, the problems that we have, although emotionally I think it's very difficult for folks. I think the reason, there are a lot of reasons for why CEOs are paid a lot. Some of the reason is because they're very skilled and they're very scarce, which is a reason that a lot of other parts of our economy are highly compensated. There's also been an explosion in baseball payer play and in actor and actress pay and in entertainer rock star pay. Those increases are all due to the fact that we have a big demand for those people's talents, and they're rare. So things that are in high demand that are rare do get compensated an enormous amount. I mean, if you look at the ratio between CEO pay and, say, the lowest paid person at a corporation, yeah, it's gone up a lot lately. You'd see the same increase if you looked at the ratio between first baseman pay and the fan in the stands, or star actress pay and the person sitting in the movie theater pay. So those are natural phenomena, I think, due to really the success of our economy and the role of technology in bringing entertainment to a larger audience, which makes it even more lucrative. On the other hand, there are people who are being paid for stuff that performance, as we see in CEOs and baseball and movie stars, for performance that's mediocre at times, and that's fun. We find that frustrating. But I think the real issue is not so much the gap for me. People can feel differently about this, but for me, the issue isn't the gap between CEO pay and worker pay in the trenches. Rather, it's whether workers are getting better off and whether fans are better off and movie patrons are better off. And there, I think the answer is yes. There's a lot of people who dispute that, who say that the average person's been stagnating in terms of economic well-being. But I think those people are misreading the economic data. I think over the last 20 and 30 years, most Americans are dramatically better off than they were before. And some are more dramatically better off than others. An example I like to use are the founders of Google. They used to be at the bottom of the income distribution. They were graduate students. Now they're among the richest people in the world, and I'm thrilled for them because I love using that search engine. It's made millions and millions of people's lives more pleasant. Now it's made their lives even more pleasant because they've captured a lot of the gains for now. But competition will reduce those gains, and I don't begrudge them that. I'm thrilled. I'm better off too.
Max, glad you called. Thanks very much. 801-585-WEST, again, that number. Here are two emails. Catherine asks what I'm guessing is a rhetorical question. How can you say there is too much regulation on Wall Street when we have all seen what happens when the fox watches the chicken coop? Dave writes this, using the cover of free market capitalism heavily promoted by the Republican Party over the last 40 years, the current version of the robber barons of the Gilded Age have brought the world financial system to the brink of collapse. Dave writes, privatize the profits and socialize the losses. Is it how it works? This is the result of unregulated greed.
Well,
you want to respond?
Yeah, sure. I want to mention, by the way, that if people are interested in my book, they can find it at Amazon, where it is currently out of stock, but we'll be back in stock in the next 2 days.
Okay.
So please be patient if you're interested in a copy. Let me comment on those 2 points. First, the Republicans talk about deregulation and free market capitalism, but they're not very good capitalists and they're not very good deregulators. Regulation has grown steadily under President Bush, not in every area, of course, but it has increased. Government spending has increased dramatically. He's not a limited government guy or a small government guy or a free market guy. And as the writer writes, a lot of times it's the fox guarding the hen house, and that's whether it's a Democrat in office or a Republican. Regulations are often, again, the result of political pressure rather than fighting for the interests of the little guy or the consumer or the average person. They're couched in language that makes it sound like they're trying to protect us, but often they are more anti-competitive than pro-competitive. Now, in the case of the financial system, a lot of the regulations that were in place that did socialize those losses, like Fannie and Freddie, were the result of, I think, mistaken regulation. Now, the real question is this. Is there regulation we can put in place? Whether suppose you're not on my side. Suppose you think that I'm crazy, that free markets are prone to disaster and that this current situation is a perfect example of it, and this proves that we have to regulate more. Fine. What regulations can we put in place in the real world, not in the world of theory, in the real world, that will protect people from greed and malfeasance and negligence and out-and-out theft and fraud? What regulations can we put in place that will reduce those things and still maintain some of the incentives to create opportunity and wealth that the current system has? That's the challenge. It's easy to say, gosh, if government could just run this system, it would work better. The question is, will it? What examples do we have? What's the empirical evidence? What's the historical evidence that when government intervened in these kinds of ways to protect us, that it did a good job? Because I think you want to consider the alternative model. The alternative model is, right now, there's an immense, if anything, too much natural resistance to risk that people are very, very careful about right now because of what's gone on. So right now, it's not. We don't need so many regulations to protect people from too much risk-taking. People are very, very cautious because they've been burned or worried about being burned in the current situation. So the analogy I like to use is, if you want to make your car safer, what should you do? Should you put in airbags and seatbelts, or should you not? Well, we all know that airbags and seatbelts are a good idea, but they do tend to encourage people to drive a little less carefully. So the more we protect people from risk, the more risk-taking there will be. That's what we've seen with Fannie and Freddie. That's what we've seen with different parts of the financial system. So I think if, no matter which side of this debate you're on, the search for a risk-free world is a dangerous pursuit because it's an illusion to think we can live in a world without risk, a world where everything is guaranteed. Much of the problem we're in now is from different kinds of guarantees that turned out not to be reliable, whether they were of housing market guarantees or loans, AIG or the federal government. Right now, we're at risk of the federal government because of so many promises it's made to bail people out that it's not going to be able to keep those promises, whether it's to Social Security recipients or Medicaid recipients or bondholders. We're really on a dangerous path. We're going to have to say no, and that's very hard for us to do.
Let's go back to the phones. John is with us. John's in Salt Lake City. John, not much time, but welcome.
Thank you so much for having me on, Doug.
Sure.
I had more of a comment, but maybe a little bit of a question to your guest. It seems to be just a prevailing attitude that's come about in the last while. I don't know if people would admit to it, but since there are very few physical boundaries for America's manifest destiny, it seems like the financial boundaries are the next areas for us to go. And whether that means, you know, we spend our money on frivolous crap or if it's actually something of value, it's just, you know, nothing really. I don't know. Like, the value of the money has gone out because there is, you know, there's just limitless potential of what we can spend it on. And I don't know, like, how we can change that attitude to get people back to, I don't know, maybe having a look at it and having some frugality in their mind.
Well, living within your means, Russell Roberts. What do you think?
Well, it's always a good idea. It's what we teach our children. It's not always how we live, but it's definitely what we teach our children. But you know, I think, and it's an interesting point to think of financial markets as the frontier. And there's a lot of creativity there. Some of it didn't turn out so well. But I certainly agree with the point that living within your means is probably a good strategy.
Let me ask you this finally. Barack Obama promised to listen to diverse opinions. Is he listening to supply-siders such as yourself? Or is this idea of massive public spending a fait accompli at this point?
It's a great question. You know, people ask me, well, if you're against the stimulus, what would you do instead? Well, I think there are things we could do instead. Obama's tax cut is not much of a tax cut that he's talked about. It's going to be a rebate of payroll tax money, is not going to have the kind of incentive effects that a true tax cut would have. But I think it's an opportunity not to do nothing, but to do creative things that are better public policy. Reforming the tax system would be a good idea. Reducing our reliance on a multiple-tiered system of payroll tax, income tax would be a good idea. I think spending less would be a good idea, and signaling to the world that we're going to spend wisely. But I think politically, as you point out, I'm sure Obama's economic advisors and Obama are aware of the kind of skepticism that I and others have about the stimulus plan, but they have to do something politically that looks proactive. This is what is dramatic. It's going to have political payoff for them. So I wouldn't say it's a fait accompli, but and I encourage everybody to speak up with their own opinions on it in the debate, because I think this is going to be a watershed moment. We're on the verge of a great social experiment. Spending $1 trillion when unemployment is 6.7 as opposed to 15 or worse, in the hopes of averting that kind of situation. So we're going to see a natural, something close to a natural experiment. And I'm not optimistic about it, but that's just, maybe I'll be wrong.
Russell Roberts, the author of the book, The Price of Everything, A Parable of Possibility and Prosperity. Thanks very much for the time today.
Oh, it was great. Enjoyed it.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program directed by Mike Anderson, produced by Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.